This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, January the 31st, 2014. Hello and a very warm welcome to this week's edition of the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. We'll be reading extracts for you from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending 31st of January 2014. Christine Aston and Fredina Hearn were our editors this week. I'm Ros Lydiard, your presenter for today, and this week your readers are Claire.
Hello.
Robin.
Hello.
And Jerry.
Hello.
And we'll begin with the main headlines, which this week are: Police may scrap city office location. Leisure centre has become a political football, says Leader. And call for clarity on the future of Royal Hampshire County Hospital. So, Claire, please, can we have your first headline story?
Police may scrap city office location. Force could merge back office functions with fire service. Hampshire Police are considering leaving Winchester completely as part of cost-cutting measures. The force was due to relocate its headquarters from Romsey Road to Mottisfont Court, but the Hampshire Chronicle understands that plan could be scrapped. Talks have been ongoing with Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service about merging back office services and potentially sharing an HQ in Eastleigh. The police are in discussions with two potential buyers for their current headquarters and could be close to accepting an offer. It comes just days after it was revealed that the White Elephant Alpha Park, the Chandler's Ford base bought 6 years ago for £9 million, has finally been sold at a loss for the taxpayer. Now, the Chronicle has learned that the police could be on the verge of shelving plans to relocate in Winchester, despite having bought Mottisfont Court on the High Street from the County Council for £1.5 million and planning to move 150 staff there. While there is no official word on the idea, it will cause speculation that the fire service headquarters in Lee Road, Eastleigh, could be the perfect location. The idea is given weight by the government's proposal to scrap fire authorities in favour of a PCC taking charge of both organisations. The idea, mooted last November by Justice Minister Damien Green, was welcomed by Hampshire PCC Simon Hayes, who supports any plan for closer working. And in a meeting last week in London, in which Mr. Green addressed all PCCs, it was said to be once again at the forefront of discussions and something the government is keen to bring in. Now it is understood that Hampshire has been asked to consider piloting the idea that aims to increase accountability and driving through reform in the fire service. It is not clear if and when that will happen. The current boss of Hampshire Fire Authority, Royston Smith, criticised the idea. Councillor Smith, the former Tory leader of Southampton City Council, said, "The only synergy with police and fire is that they are two uniformed organisations, but what they do is very different. It is something that someone has looked at, with all due respect to them, without knowing the details of the two jobs. If the whole driving force is to find an efficiency, the efficiency is so minuscule it is almost not worth doing. For efficiencies, fire and ambulance works better than fire and police. It is more than a step too far. It is something that I don't think will work at all." Already this month, Hampshire Police, which employs 5,702, 3,470 of them police officers, has asked Band D taxpayers to find an extra £5 a year to offset spending cuts. As previously reported, in the wake of making savings of more than £50 million, the force now faces finding a way to slice another £25 million from its budget. At the fire service, where there are 1,929 employees, the situation doesn't seem quite so desperate. This week, it was revealed there is no plan to raise council tax this year due to a £2.5 million surplus, having already strived to make savings through a variety of forms, including freezing recruitment. But a report due to go before Hampshire Fire Authority reveals a funding gap of £12 million in 3 years' time, and that residents should expect council tax increases from 2015 onwards. Mr. Hayes said, "The estate's strategy of the force is built on working with other publicly funded bodies, and we are talking to Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service about opportunities we might have in the future. Selling Alpha Park gives us some capital to reinvest in new locations for us." John Apter, chairman of Hampshire Police Federation, said, "If this is a genuine way forward, then I think the idea has got merit, but we would really have to look at the governments around it, and it would need a close eye. As an alternative to privatising chunks of the police force, I think it's a good idea, and importantly, it keeps ownership local. But I'd like to see the detail."
"Leisure centre has become a political football," says Leader. Winchester Civic Chief Keith Wood believes opposition to his River Park leisure plans is politically motivated. Councillor Wood says the campaign to stop the rebuild of the centre onto parkland at River Park has become a political football. "I think there is a move to derail the whole thing," he said. "All I want to do is build a new leisure centre for the people of Winchester." Councillor Wood said the window of favourable economic circumstances of cheap building costs and low interest rates was beginning to close. "The rising costs have probably added a million to the scheme." He wrote to Lib Dem Councillor Martin Todd after he raised concerns about the lack of consultation between the city and county councils about an alternative site at Bar End. Councillor Todd said a Freedom of Information Act request had shown little contact between the two authorities. In a letter to Councillor Wood, he said, "The level of engagement with the county council, as a major landowner at Bar End and as a possible supporter of new sports facilities for the county and the city, is not even close to what I would have expected." Councillor Keith Chapman, executive member for Culture, Recreation and Countryside at the County Council, wrote to Councillor Todd, "We have not been formally approached by the City Council to make land available at Bar End. Should there be such an approach, then we would be interested in having a three-way meeting to discuss the matter in more detail." But Councillor Wood rebutted the Todd claim. "He is talking rubbish. We have been talking to Council Leader Roy Perry. I spoke to then-leader Ken Thornber about its museum site at Bar End and tried to buy it from them. But the county needs to retain it, so it is not an option." In a letter to Councillor Todd, Councillor Wood wrote, "I have heard rumours that some Lib Dems are determined to derail the council's plans to provide new leisure facilities for the residents of Winchester." Last week, a local resident complained about the allegedly highly irregular handling of a contract to run the centre. Martin Wilson said there was potential maladministration in the way DC Leisure had the contract to run the centre extended in 2009. Simon Eden, chief executive of the City Council, said the decision was properly made. Campaigners also say the possible discovery of a bone from King Alfred, just yards from the centre, was further argument against the scheme.
Call for clarity on future of RHCH. Councillors have raised safety concerns over a controversial NHS shake-up that would see the Royal Hampshire County Hospital downgraded. As reported, Hampshire Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, which runs hospitals in Winchester, Basingstoke and Andover, is looking at plans for a new super hospital. Specialist services would be centralised and moved away from Winchester, either at Basingstoke or on a patch of land north of the city, and the RHCH would lose some specialist services. Winchester would be left with a walk-in unit for less serious A and E cases and a midwife-led maternity unit for natural births only. But Dr. Nigel Sylvester, Vice Clinical Chair of West Hampshire Clinical Commissioning Group and a Winchester GP, said that 80% of care would remain at the RHCH and that creating a new centre to treat the most critical cases was vital. At a meeting of health bosses on Tuesday, councillors demanded clarification from the Health Trust. Councillor Martin Todd said the Trust needed to clarify its plans. You talk of having an exciting vision for Basingstoke and Winchester hospitals, but it's not clear what that vision is, he said. Councillor Pat West, chairman of Hampshire County Council's Health and Overview Scrutiny Committee, told NHS representatives that councillors had a number of concerns about the plans. The hyperacute stroke unit at the RHCH will be downgraded, and stroke patients from across the area will be transferred to the new critical treatment hospital. At present, about 3,000 women per year give birth at the RHCH, which has the full range of obstetricians, paediatricians, anaesthetists and midwives. The committee heard that pregnant women classed as high-risk first-time mums or those with complications during pregnancy would be encouraged to give birth at the new centre. Councillor Fiona Mather raised concerns about births that were not initially considered high risk, but which later became more complex. She said she found it hard to believe that this would only affect a very small proportion of women. One disaster is too many, she said. Dr. Sylvester sought to reassure the council and said it needed to look at ways of reducing any risk, as it currently does with those who choose a home birth. He said, I feel a great sense of responsibility to make sure Winchester and the surrounding area have great care. The new hospital will be manned by staff from Winchester and Basingstoke, but this does not mean that we leave these hospitals bereft. Specialist staff will still be available to offer advice, but critical care will be located at the treatment centre. Following last year's public engagement, next month we'll see a formal public consultation progress.
And those were the headline stories. Thank you all. And now we're going to go on to the death notices, and then Claire will be reading Christian comment for us. The notices begin with Brown. Eileen Louise Brown, peacefully at home on the 27th of January, aged 73.
Carey, Dr. Audrey Carey, née Coughlin, previously consultant physician and rheumatologist at Royal Hampshire County Hospital, on 16th January, aged 96.
Dunk, Hildegard Hilda Dunk, 15th of January, aged 91.
Godfrey, Roy Wyndham Godfrey, previously head of art at Barton Peveril College Eastleigh, in his sleep, 25th of January.
Hansford, Penelope Hansford, 17th of January.
Hole, Gerald, Jerry, William Hole, 18th of January, aged 78.
Howell, Vera Howell, late of New Farm Leckford, 21st of January, aged 93.
Mancy, Kathleen Ann Mancy, 22nd of January, aged 80.
And Claire will give us Christian comment now, please.
This is headed Alfred the Great, a leader for our times, and is written by Mary Gray. When I was a child, taught about Alfred the Great, what made a deep impression on me, along with the famous burning of the cake story, was that when Alfred became king and defeated the Danes in 878, one of the terms of the surrender was that the Danish king Guthrum would convert to Christianity. 3 weeks later, this king and 29 chiefs were baptized at Alfred's court, with Alfred receiving Guthrum as his spiritual son. So, whereas it's great that his presumed pelvic bone has been unearthed, and congratulations to the Winchester University team, there is far more to be said about Alfred's significance to our city and our country. Of course, we have had monarchs of great spiritual depth, but of no one else could it be said that they were brought at the age of 4 in 853 to visit Pope Leo IV in Rome, who anointed the small boy as future king, confirmed him, and regarded him as his adopted son. 2 years later, his father took him back to Rome, where he remained for a whole year. 20 years later, Alfred became king. We think of him as having a reign dominated by the struggle to keep out the Danes and as being a great military leader, an image reflected by the 19th century statue in Winchester. This is true, but there is a deep spiritual dimension to his leadership that was unique. Yes, Alfred was learned in a time when learning was not esteemed, when people were illiterate, and where libraries had been destroyed by constant warfare. But his was not learning for learning's sake, more a search for true wisdom that in his case was based on a deep faith inspired by scripture. This gave a wisdom that he longed to be shared by his bishops through the legal system that he created, the civil organization he set up on principles of justice, and the schools he created, not only for privileged royal children, but for poorer children who joined them. What is amazing in this monarch, very much a hands-on leader of troops, was that his was no second-hand learning. Yes, his devotional life was exemplary, but he personally translated important Latin texts, especially the famous work of Pope Gregory the Great, Pastoral Rule, meant for the spiritual and intellectual qualities necessary for a person in ecclesiastical office, but for secular office too. From childhood, he must have known his own calling to be king should be lived out in this profound way, something for Winchester and beyond to cherish. And that was written by Mary Gray.
Thank you, Claire. And it's time for letters to the editor now, and we have 9 this week. Robin, going to read the first, please.
The first letter is from Jan Field, chairman of the Alsford Society, with the title Alsford Under Siege from HGVs. On behalf of well over 100 signatories to our petition to reduce HGVs in Alsford and nearby villages, I'd like to add to MP Steve Brine's recent comments. Firstly, our concern is heavy through traffic. It is an accident of history and geography that this area is subjected night and day to such a volume and weight of traffic. Currently being updated, data collected by Hampshire County Council in October 2012 identified that of 4,321 traffic movements over a 4-day period, 1,421 were very large vehicles, 6.5 to 11.5 metres long. Diverting this traffic onto other country lanes is no solution. We recognise the Watercress Company grows local produce and employs people who live locally, thereby benefiting the community, and its traffic is not our worry. Not all heavy traffic is down to Alsford Salads, of course, but its expansion has been far more than anticipated. It processes salads from overseas, distributing them in mega lorries that damage local infrastructure and property, creating noise and pollution and risking the health and safety of pedestrians and other road users. Local employment is vital, and the local economy is increasingly dependent upon tourism. Visitors come to see our lovely old town, not to be subjected to huge lorries. In February, we will present our concerns to councillors, asking them to review the situation. We understand that there are no easy solutions, but doing nothing, as Mr. Brine said, is unsustainable. Readers can help this petition at http://www.truckedoff.org.uk. Jan Field, Chairman of the Alsford Society.
This letter is from Andrew Rutter and is headed Need for Peace Greater Than Ever. You recently drew attention to the upcoming public exhibition on the subject of the Great War and families' memories in connection with it. As Quakers, we would like the public to know we are preparing an additional exhibition in the Quaker Meeting House Garden this autumn. As a religious body, founded at a time of bitter civil war in England, which concluded that wars were nothing to do with Jesus' teaching, our menfolk were faced with a particular challenge due to national conscription to supply the number of soldiers required. Many Quakers registered as conscientious objectors to uphold their principles and were sent to prison. Many also served in the Friends ambulance units in both world wars, which was challenging and dangerous. Now, when the rapid advance of technology is bringing massive suffering and death to civilian populations, and we have retained the power to destroy whole cities at a strike, we believe more resources and effort are needed to understand and eradicate the reasons for wars. That is why the United Nations was set up. They have now pointed out the urgency of tackling climate change, already afflicting poorer countries with the potential to create massive extra refugee problems. Our grandchildren will have to grapple with this. We hope to show it is honourable to devote part or all of one's life to peacemaking, guided by love, to set against the constant fear of wars, and help provide the talented personnel the UN urgently needs to fulfil its functions. Andrew Rutter, St John's Road, Winchester.
Traffic plans will hit house prices, is the title of this letter. Re Andrew Beadle's letter of January 23rd, I have yet to see a single comment in your columns in favour of the diversion of Andover Road through a housing estate. The concreting over of Barton Farm will provide enough traffic problems without this. Vehicle numbers will soar. A reasonable estimate of resident car numbers produced by 2,000 houses will be 1,500, plus all the visitor, delivery and service vehicles that will be involved. The plans of the homes adjoining the avenue do not appear to incorporate garages or adequate driveways. The conclusion must be that there will have to be bilateral parking, together with provision for pedestrians, cyclists, through traffic, some of it heavy, and no doubt buses with occasional stopping places. I wonder if Carla Holmes is aware that their traffic plans will detract significantly from the selling price of their houses in parts of the estate. Surely a planning revision must be made in the interest of everyone. Ken Leslie, Constablesgate, Winchester.
And James McConachie of Egbert Road, Winchester, says it's time to recognise King Alfred Park. To celebrate the recent discovery of bones, Alfred's bones, at River Park, it's time we properly acknowledged the national importance of this site. Let's rename it King Alfred Park. Why? The park already has two names, confusingly. River Park is easily muddled with River Park Leisure Centre, while North Walls Recreation Ground is depressingly downbeat. The new name would celebrate historic connections and rich archaeology and attract tourist attention. It would acknowledge Winchester's pride in our city's big green lung, a city park used by the entire community. The new name isn't even new. When our city bought the land in 1901-2 for £5,350, the mayor, Alfred Bowker, ventured to hope the city would find it advisable to name the proposed new park after the great king who was buried there, as a worthy memorial to remind future generations of good accomplished by the present inhabitants of Winchester. So let's do some good for future generations too. When Winchester bought the land, the vendor, William Barrow Simmons, sold it under a conveyance that it would be a public park or recreation ground for the city, for recreation or scientific purposes only. The conveyance still stands. So let's not despoil it with a giant leisure centre and car park, as Winchester City Council has proposed, to its shame, but make it a place of outdoor recreation, science and history, set perfectly between Winnell Moors Nature Reserve and the city centre. Let's have open-air exercise stations and cycle routes, climbing trees and orchards, a wildlife pond and swimming pond. There was one in 1901. The Heritage Lottery Fund makes money available for just such projects. Let's not just rename the park, then, but seek to make it worthy of Winchester's proud past and its energetic, imaginative future. James McConachie, Egbert Road, Winchester.
This letter is headed City Committed to Affordable Homes, and it comes from Councillor Victoria Weston. The Wolverstone application referred to by Karen Barrett in her letter of January 23rd was unusual in that the developer proposed far fewer homes than currently exists on site, and so the council couldn't require the development to provide affordable housing. In most cases, applicants look to redevelop sites for a greater number, and in such circumstances, the council seeks the provision of affordable homes on or off-site under its planning policies. However, as well as the homes provided by reason of our planning policies, the council maintains a strong commitment to delivering affordable housing itself. Plans are in hand for 150-plus new homes towards our 300-home target, including the site of the new Queen's Head, Stanmore, a 50-bed extra care scheme, and Victoria House in Winchester. Andrew Beadle suggests a direct comparison between plans for Silver Hill and proposals for 2,000 homes at Barton Farm, and calls to look again at the plan to divert Andover Road, which forms part of the approved scheme. The Silver Hill developer has decided to review the consent with a view to making some changes, whereas Carla Homes are content to proceed with the permission granted them by the Secretary of State, which includes the alterations to Andover Road. As a result, the council has to deal with the detailed proposals being submitted to implement the scheme, which has already received permission at Barton Farm. Councillor Victoria Weston, WCC portfolio holder for built environment.
This letter is from Christopher Pankhurst, and he's entitled it, "They're Starving the NHS to Death." I wonder how many readers are aware of a recent report which shows that 70% of NHS contracts since April 2013 have been awarded to private providers. It is a national picture and involves the last 400 contracts with a total worth of £5 billion. This will, of course, have the consequence of starving and shrinking the NHS, so that it will be increasingly less able to tender for future contracts. The clear intention is to starve it to death and replace it with American-style health provision, which will, of course, mean that people have to take out expensive and inefficient health insurance. Christopher Pankhurst, Greenhill Road, Full Flood, Winchester.
Tanya Donaldson of Oliver's Battery says Basics Bank relies on its volunteers. I was glad you reported on the Basics Bank's 10th birthday, Chronicle, January the 23rd. Although when you mentioned the dignitaries who joined trustees and staff, you neglected to say that the guests were just a few of the many volunteers without whom the Basics Bank would not exist. There are only two paid, part-time staff, and many volunteers who turn out to sort clothes and food, make up food parcels, attend to clients, and drive to Andover to collect carloads of fresh food and vegetables. All the trustees also give of their time voluntarily. Tanya Donaldson, former trustee, Old Kennels Lane, Oliver's Battery.
We really were there at the start, says Peter Pooley. In your issue of January the 16th, Mrs. Robinson's account of the UK's absence at the foundation of the EU was factually, historically, absolutely correct. Would that all our debates over Europe were informed with such a meticulous regard for factual accuracy. Writing as another historian, I think she misses a point or two. In the 1950s, we stood aside as the first building blocks were laid. We were still encumbered by dreams of empire and doubted that the six nations concerned had the capacity to realise the dream. Then in the 1960s, we were blocked by de Gaulle, who feared losing French leadership. But in a real sense, we were there before the beginning, for we had in that half century twice stood in the breach for European liberties, at enormous cost in lives and resources, and for some while alone. Then we had mobilised the free world, with great force and conviction, to resist the further advance of the totalitarian Soviet Empire. In a longer perspective, our European credentials are impeccable, perhaps unmatched. They go back a long way, and they still stand to our great credit with other members of the EU. In a shorter perspective, we have had, I believe, a major role in building the Europe of today. John Major was the leading architect for the eastward enlargement, turning the former Eastern Bloc states into a modern, democratic, open society with free market economies. For 40 years, two-thirds of the years elapsed since the beginning, we have been providing leadership. We cannot stop there. The challenge is to lead the development of Europe and do so in ways compatible with our inherited British values. Peter Pooley, Rosebery Road, Alsford.
There's a picture here of the Cathedral Christmas Market, saying that it brings thousands into the city. And the title of the letter is Complainant, Often the Perpetrator. In his comments regarding the Christmas traffic problems in our city, A.P. Lodge, Chronicle, January the 16th, illustrates the fact that the complainant is often the perpetrator. His, her friends came from Romsey and Weymouth, which means they either missed or ignored signage to the park and ride facility, which provided a good service into the city all day, every day, until late in the evening. By using it, potential visitors could have saved themselves stress and expense, and would have helped reduce pressure on our overcrowded streets. Alternatively, they could have come here by bus or train, both of which would have been available. E. Horn, Sussex Street, Winchester.
And those are the letters to the editor this week. If you have an opinion or a subject you would like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, well, you can contact them on 01962 860 836. That's 01962 860 836. Or you can email them at news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. Or you could go the good old-fashioned way of writing to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. And talking about good old-fashioned ways, we've got historical items now for you. I'll start off with 200 years ago. And these next two items were reported on January the 31st, 1814. The first is acquitted of cowardice charge. A court-martial has been held at Sheerness to try Captain Rennick of His Majesty's sloop Mercurius on a charge of cowardice in not chasing a Danish brig of war on the coast of Norway. Captain R was most honourably acquitted. The trial took place at the instance of the second lieutenant of the Mercurius, who is to be tried by a court-martial for preferring such a charge against his captain. The second item is, last week, a gentleman was thrown down in Holborn in consequence of slipping from the frozen hillocks in the front of a jeweller's shop, when his head came in contact with an iron scraper, by which it was severely cut. On rising, he was so much irritated that with his stick he broke 10 panes of glass, which he refused to pay for, and was borne out by the mob. This may operate as caution to prevent similar inattention to the public safety in future.
100 years ago, January 31st, 1914, hotel to become variety theatre. The work of converting the Market Hotel, Jury Street, into a picture variety theatre for Messrs. J. and J. Simpkins, lessees of the Palace of Varieties, has commenced, and within the space of the next month or so, a very notable transformation will assert itself. The present elevation will be, for all practical purposes, the same, and in the place of the existing balcony will be a large glass portico, sufficient to protect those arriving at the theatre by carriage from any inclement weather that might prevail. And the second paragraph. On Tuesday, the London coal strike collapsed. Finding there was no truth in the report that a number of other firms were about to follow the lead of Sir Edwin Cornwall and concede the extra penny per ton demanded, hundreds of men literally stampeded back to work, and on Wednesday morning, 4/5 of the strikers had resumed their employment upon the old terms. The men held a meeting on Tuesday morning and accepted the proposals of their executive that there should be a return to work in the case of those firms who had offered improved conditions.
50 years ago, February the 1st, 1964, Head supports leaving age rise. Full support for the Newsom Report's suggestion that the school leaving age be raised to 16 was expressed this week by Miss A.E. Waymont, headmistress of Danemark School, Winchester. If the girls stay at school until they are 16, their most restless adolescent years will be over, and they can be sent out into the world fortified by the training they have received in our school, she declared. Miss Waymont, speaking of the school speech day on Wednesday, referred to reports of anxiety among teachers that children already difficult to control would behave worse if kept at school a year longer. I believe we should have more faith both in education and our young people, she commented.
Well, we heard from Claire about the beginning of the picture house in Jury Street in 1914. This piece from 25 years ago, February the 3rd, 1989, deals with its closure. The Theatre Royal may be forced to close following a decision to sever the playhouse's lifeline by councillors responsible for social and recreational facilities. Just 4 days after the closure of Winchester's only cinema, they jeopardised the future of live theatre in the city by refusing to give it any more money. An increase in the annual grant of £22,100 to £56,145 was requested to cover running costs, but the proposal was outvoted 11-8, and the subsidy will now be limited to just £23,430 plus inflation. The open door work carried out by Winchester's Trinity Centre Association has expanded so much in the 2 years it has been operating that the centre urgently needs extra space. Holy Trinity Church, which invited the centre to use its premises in 1986, has no more space available, and it has decided to terminate the centre's use of its premises after Easter. So the search is now on for premises which will allow the centre's self-help groups and creative activities to run alongside the original Open Door service. Open Door is an open access, advice, information and support service on issues affecting the unemployed, ex-offenders, homeless and those with drug and alcohol problems. And the final item from 1989... I wonder if many people feel as I do the deepest wish that the whole form of church services could be vitally changed. No doubt there are some members of congregations with sure faith who find satisfaction and inspiration in rehearsing traditional ritual. But for those who seek to find the truth, who come with burning questions to be resolved, the service can be devoid of all they so earnestly seek and frustrating. A large part of each service could be given to teaching, preaching and reading, with opportunities to bring into open discussion points of greatest importance and difficulty.
And whilst Jerry is still at the mic, she has your say for us.
Which this week asked members of the public, do you think the public is getting good value for the royal family? Cliff Walters, 19, a student of Romsey Road, Winchester, said, "Well, I'm not bothered. I don't pay too much attention to them or what they cost. If it's only 60 pence per person or whatever, I don't really care." Roy Duncan, 51, a fitter of Ploughway Badger Farm, said, "I'd say they're value for money. They're ambassadors for the country and do a good job at that. That said, I think they could be a bit more self-sufficient." Judy Tattersall, 21, another student of Winnall Manor Road, Winnall, said, "They're worth it. The royal family is what makes England, England. They're privileged, but I'd rather see that privilege go to them than to footballers, for example." And Rebecca Appleton, 32, an interior designer of Romsey, said, "I think the royals are doing a great job and are worth the money. They're becoming more real, which is appealing to the youngsters."
Thank you, Jerry. And all those people who had their own say. The next item is editorial comment. It's headed this time, Public Services Fit for the 21st Century. It looks like Hampshire Constabulary will, at some point, sever its connection with Winchester, the county town, dating back to the reign of Queen Victoria. As reported on the front page, the force is in talks about moving its headquarters from Romsey Road to the fire service base in Lee Road, Eastleigh. It would mean the scrapping of the plan to relocate to Mottisfont Court by the Westgate. That proposal followed the axing of the move to Alpha Park in Chandler's Ford. The relocation would certainly have an impact, with the loss of hundreds of staff coming daily into Winchester, although the Romsey Road site will be replaced by several hundred new homes, so in effect, any economic consequences for local business would be minimal. The catalyst for the talks between the two 999 services is the need to make savings with cuts in Whitehall funding. Yet there is much to commend the reduction of any unnecessarily duplication in the backroom services of both authorities. If the end result of closer cooperation is more efficient public services for the 21st century, then losing the police historic administration ties with Winchester will be a price worth paying. And our next item is first person, please, and that's Robbins.
And first person this week is by George Hayter, with the title Quiet Accountant Who Survived as Railway Man. A shocking film on general release last month, and starring a well-known Hampshire actor, has reminded me of a book I have at home. I'll come to the film in a minute, but let me tell you first about the moving book called One for Every Sleeper. Written by a friend of my late father, it was given to me by my mother shortly before her death. The little-known author was Geoffrey English, an accountant who lived in Brockenhurst. One for Every Sleeper is an autobiography dealing with two terrifying years when Mr. English was in his 20s. He was a major in the army in Singapore in 1942, when the British garrison there surrendered to the besieging Japanese. Interned British servicemen were force-marched north to construct the infamous Burma Railway. They were among 60,000 Allied soldiers used as slave labour to build the precarious jungle line wanted by the Japanese to supply their troops in Burma. Though ridden with malaria, cholera and dysentery, the British POWs were starved and beaten mercilessly by their workmasters. The reason for the book's title is that someone is said to have died for every sleeper on which the 250-mile line rests. Of the author's own squad of 400, fewer than 100 survived, and Mr. English's moving account can certainly generate indignation. I punch the air in triumph when a tiny moment of retribution in death comes halfway through the book. Mr. English describes how the Japanese were tormenting prisoners by forcing them to hold sledgehammers above their heads for up to 2 hours while standing on the edge of a precipice. The book goes on. One prisoner, realizing that he was going to fall backwards, managed to grip the shirt of his tormentor and took him with him over the top to their deaths in the ravine far below. Japanese treatment of Chinese civilians in Singapore was even worse, the book makes clear, and outrages by the occupying Japanese in China remain a cause of resentment by the Beijing government even today. That anger lies behind the current Chinese aggression against Japan's Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. Critics have claimed that the history of World War II is not taught properly in Japanese schools and that the Japanese have never acknowledged their evil doing in that period. Cruelty on the Burma Railway is also the subject of The Railway Man, starring our own Colin Firth, who grew up in Winchester. The film homes in on a prisoner's inquisition by torture and the later efforts of the tortured man to come to terms with his ordeal. Anyone curious about the Burma Railway might like to know that One for Every Sleeper is available for Amazon for as little as £2.81 second hand. It is a gripping read.
And our next item is the Westminster Diary, and this is from Steve Brine this week, MP for Winchester and Chandler's Ford, and Claire is going to be his voice for us, please.
And he says, This week, I turn 40. My kids seem genuinely excited by the idea of a birthday, or put another way, chocolate cake, in the house, but I can't say I'm exactly over the moon. And as if to make the point, I had a letter from my GP saying I was now eligible for an NHS health check. It was a reminder not just of my own mortality, but how one way or another we all use and rely on local NHS services. That, of course, includes me and my family. We've actually had two children at Winchester Hospital in recent years and care deeply about its future. So my priority here and in Parliament continues to be health. I'm a passionate supporter of the NHS, which is why I back the Prime Minister's determination to increase health spending year on year. That means NHS spending will be almost £13 billion higher in 2015 than it was in 2010. But we should be honest, our view of the NHS should be a balance between recognising strengths and the need for improvements to make it a world-class public service for the long term. The investment from government, the new local commissioning structure, and our new hospital trust are key to that. We have huge challenges ahead as the new Foundation Health Trust across Winchester, Chandler's Ford, Andover and Basingstoke considers how it can provide high-quality, safe and sustainable services, possibly including a new acute hospital working with our own Royal Hampshire County Hospital. Despite spending more time trying to understand the huge complexities of modern acute medicine than anything else in recent years, it is still the subject which worries me most. I remain of the view this will ultimately provide opportunities for us and demand compromise. It will also be controversial, which is why it's essential we have the opportunity to be fully informed and have our say about the future of stroke, emergency, and especially maternity services, among others. It's vital this process is led by sound, up-to-date clinical evidence, not rose-coloured views on the NHS of times past, and certainly kept well away from unhelpful party politics. The clinicians must win the argument and take us with them, not impose them change arbitrary. As widely reported in the Chronicle, discussions are taking place now which will inform any future formal consultation exercise on service change, which is why I am conducting a major health survey this year. If one hasn't yet come through your door, please visit www.stevebryan.com/priority NHS, all lowercase, and take part in it.
And here we have a couple of items from Belgarum. What's in a name? Rather a lot. Thanks to Dr. Peter Abraham for his help explaining why Allsford is pronounced Allsford, or as the 1960 Concise Oxford Dictionary of English Place Name states, Allsford. Belgarum asked the question last week and Dr. Abraham of Gascoigne Lane, Ropley, has written in to explain. It is because it is a contraction of the Anglo-Saxon Aldresford, which means belonging to the older or the elder, the prince or chief. Dr. Abram says this contrast with Allsford in Essex, pronounced Allsford, which is a contraction of Aglesford, meaning belonging to Aigel. Incidentally, the shorter Oxford Dictionary indicates that ford can mean not only a crossing place, but any tract of shallow water, he continues. Since Alsford yielded 2.5 tons of fish, particularly eels, in 1 year 900 years ago, it's not surprising that princes, secular or religious, enjoyed their ownership in Alsford, he adds. Thelgarum always thought the town names derived from something to do with alder trees. Well, now he knows. And the next heading is What's Wrong with Parking on Broadway? Councillor Robert Sanders, the Conservative member for St Michael Ward, covering St Cross, enjoys plain speaking. Not content with complaining about rapacious traffic wardens, Councillor Sanders got stuck into councillors too at the recent Overview and Scrutiny Committee. He wants to see more car parking in the Broadway, with a herringbone pattern replacing the current setup by King Alfred's statue. Councillor Saunders said, "The only night we use it is election night, when lots of councillors want to park close to the Guildhall. It works perfectly. If it is practical on election night, why is it not practical for the rest of the year?" Traffic manager Andy Hickman explained that the herringbone would deny space to the buses and coaches that need to turn round at the Broadway. But he added, "We are reviewing the arrangements as part of Silver Hill." Well, those were all the regular items chosen for you this week. And we're going to take a look now at what's on in the region over the next couple of weeks or so. If theatre is your interest, well, there's quite a lot to choose from here. The Chesil Theatre has been busy again. They're opening their play, The Effect of Gamma Rays on Man in the Moon Marigolds. Yes, that was The Effect of Gamma Rays on Man in the Moon Marigolds. They're opening on Saturday, the 1st of February, and it runs through to Saturday, the 8th of February. There's a matinee and evening performance on that date. Tickets are available from TicketSource via the Chesil website, www.chesiltheatre.org.uk, or by calling TicketSource direct on 0333 666 3366. That number again, 0333 666 3366. At the Theatre Royal in Winchester, a production of Jesus Christ Superstar is on the 13th and the 14th of February at 7:30. Further ahead at the Royal, on Friday the 21st of March at 7:30, the Swansea City Opera will be performing The Marriage of Figaro. Information on both these productions is available from the box office on 01962 840 440. 01962 840 440. And the Anvil in Basingstoke are presenting the Russian State Ballet and Orchestra on February the 7th, 8th and 9th. Their programme includes Giselle and Swan Lake, beautiful music. A Christmas concert in aid of St Matthew's Church lighting and roof appeal will be at St Paul's Church in Winchester on Saturday the 8th of February. It will contain choral works by Handel, Britten, Foray and Jerome Kern. Tickets are £10 down to £5, available from the Theatre Royal box office. That number again, 01962 840 440. Lighting up time now. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to move you on to a talk by John Pilkington. I can't miss this out. John Pilkington, a celebrated Winchester traveller, is giving a talk entitled A Balkan Adventure. This will describe his travels in the Balkan Mountains, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia and further places. They have 3 dates to catch this in the Winchester Discovery Centre. That will be Friday the 7th of February, Thursday the 20th of February and Friday the 7th of March. Admission is £10 and tickets are available from the centre on 01962 873 603. That number is 01962 873 603. I'm going to move back to lighting on that I started just now, so I'll do the whole thing. Lighting up time ends on Saturday, the 1st of February at 7:43 a.m. and begins at 4:56 p.m. And on Wednesday, the 5th of February, it ends at 7:36 a.m. and begins at 5:03 p.m. If you do know of anyone who is sight impaired and would like to receive these recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. Right, Claire, over to you for that first news item, please.
These are letters and readings of diaries of First World War soldiers. For generations, the diaries of First World War soldiers were kept under lock and key, shut away from the public's gaze. Now, finally, Hampshire people are able to read the words of the men who marched away, leaving their families and homes for an unknown future a century ago. To mark the centenary of the outbreak of conflict in 1914, the National Archives have released an enormous amount of previously unseen details and descriptions of what life was like for the soldiers who fought, lived, and died in the war that was supposed to end all wars. Amongst the vast collection of diaries which are now available on the internet are many written by soldiers of the 1st Battalion Hampshire Regiment. A search of the records finds the diary of a Major F.R. Hicks, who left with elements of the battalion from Southampton for the French port of Le Havre. Major Hicks wrote, "Sailed about noon, very calm passage. Arrived off Le Havre at 9 p.m. Considerable delays. As darkness came on, the whole column seemed hopelessly jammed on the road. Guns and transport were two or three deep, and infantry on the fields at the side of the road. It really seemed the end. Luckily, the German pursuit appeared to stop at nightfall, and the men rested until 2 a.m. in streets and houses, where the inhabitants were very kind in providing hot water and bread. The Hampshires stood to arms. Without any further warning, the shells began to burst in the village and the streets were full of screaming inhabitants trying to escape with their livestock. Soon, heavy rifle fire broke out from the southeast of the village and the enemy's guns took up shelling our men. The description of the events is taken up in a diary written by another Hampshire soldier, a private F.G. Pattenden, who wrote, "All the poor refugees are going by us, crying bitterly. Also a few of ours are wounded. What a terrible thing it is at present. What will it be like later on? We all have good, brave hearts with us, and all are prepared to help our good friends, the French. A heavy thunderstorm has just ended and we are having our baptism of fire. We began fighting at 5 a.m. It is fearful and we have a few wounded. The shrapnel shells is the chief cause. Still fighting hard, but our guns have silenced the enemy for a while. The noise at times is fearful. We marvellously escaped annihilation. We had to retire, and they caught us with shrapnel. It was nearly a wholesale rout and slaughter. Poor old Kennard is dead. My boots are beginning to pinch me." Another anonymous account talks about the loss of an officer from the 1st Battalion, a victim of enemy sniper. "He was killed by a bullet while standing on the parapet of the trench. Over 100 casualties occurred this day. The shelling got worse and worse, and many pieces of the trench were blown in. No words can describe the passage of the next 8 days. During the 16 hours of daylight, we crouched in the bottom of the trenches, listening to the bursting and shrieking of the shells. For 8 hours of darkness, we toiled at repairing and extending our lines. Some slept peacefully for most of the day, despite the noise and cramped position. Some hardly slept at all and became more and more exhausted. Our killed were all buried near the remains of a small farm and the graves marked as carefully as possible. The gallant deeds performed by the men of the regiment would fill pages. Few can be mentioned, but we may well be filled with pride for the hundreds of unnamed officers and men who did their duty so nobly, and the stretcher bearers were beyond praise. By day, the bearers would crawl along or even out of the trenches to attend the wounded. By night, carrying them from dusk to dawn, they deserve the highest praise in the roll of honour.
Peter's labour of love marks church history. A Kingsworthy man has devoted years of his life to writing a local history book. Peter Finn, 77, of Springvale Road, has been collecting research and information over a number of years on St Swithin's Church in Headbourne Worthy, and has now published his findings alongside members of the Worthy's local history group. The book, The Saxon Church of St Swithin at Headbourne Worthy, features nearly 1,000 years of history of the church and documents its evolution. Mr Finn, who had help taking the photographs for the book from his son Damien Finn, 43, and granddaughter Eleanor Finn, 23, is chairman of the Worthy's local history group. He said, "The objective of doing this is not only to record the past, but to inform future generations. Here, we have a church that was near ruination near the beginnings of the 19th century, and now it has been saved." Mr. Finn has developed his passion for history since his retirement, and the book features detailed historical accounts from periods of embellishment and decay to a resurgence in the 1860s, as well as a full list of rectors and patrons from 1285. It costs £10 and can be purchased by calling 01962 885266. I'll repeat that, 01962 885266, or by searching the Worthy History Group online. And the item is illustrated by a picture of Peter Finn standing in front of the church with a copy of his book in his hand.
County to invest £149 million in schools. Hampshire schools bosses are making one of their largest investments in schools building in recent years. A £149 million programme is proposed as part of Hampshire County Council's Children's Services Capital 2014-17. Following years of criticism that not enough schools are being built to match demand, particularly in Winchester, it aims to ensure that there is a school place for every child in Hampshire. The council says it will also provide a boost for the economy through jobs and materials in the construction industry. The proposals were considered by the Children and Young People Select Committee before the recommendations were put to the leader and cabinet last Wednesday. Keith Manns, Executive Lead Member for Children's Services, said, "This is the further substantial programme of investment that is being proposed, and if agreed, will be extremely good news for schools and children in Hampshire. We are acutely aware of the increasing need for additional primary school places due to the rising birth rate and more families moving into the county attracted by the quality of education in Hampshire. Capital investment is essential if we are to meet this need, and the local authority capital grants announced by the Secretary of State for Education are welcomed." Peter Edgar, Executive Member for Education, added, Our objective is to deliver quality education locally, near to where children live, and where parents want them to go to school. Councillor Edgar added, "We've already provided more than 900 additional new places at schools, including Pilgrim's Cross in Andover, Cornerstone at Whiteley, Bramley Church of England Primary School in Tadley, and Coppenham Infant and Junior School, Romsey. But we know that up to 8,000 places are needed over the next few years. The total capital programme of over £237 million includes funding proposals to ensure that existing school buildings are maintained in good condition, together with other improvements on school sites and better provision for pupils with special educational needs. Investment is also proposed to upgrade school kitchen and dining facilities to accommodate an increased take-up of school meals following the government's initiative to provide free school meals for all children in their first 3 years of school."
Bearing in mind I read earlier Mary Gray's article about Alfred the Great, this is a little more about him. An exhibition explains a search for Alfred. A pop-up exhibition, In Search of Alfred the Great, has opened in St Bartholomew's Church in Winchester. Curated by the community group Hyde 900, the exhibition tells the story of King Alfred, from the burial at Hyde Abbey in 1110 to the modern-day search for his final resting place. The latest findings were revealed in a BBC Two documentary last week. Last year, the BBC film crew joined Hyde 900 and university archaeologists too for the exhumation of a grave in St Bartholomew's in Hyde. Radiocarbon dating revealed the remains were not old enough to belong to the West Saxon royal family. But further research by archaeologist Katie Tucker, researcher in human osteology at the University of Winchester, led to the discovery of a pelvic bone most likely to belong to either King Alfred the Great or his son, King Edward the Elder. Edward Fennell, founder of Hyde 900, said, "The story of the bones is complicated and includes the dissolution of the monastery of Hyde, the construction of a bridewell in 1778, when the royal graves were first discovered, and the somewhat infamous involvement of John Mellor, an amateur archaeologist in the 1860s. As in the TV programme, the exhibition at St Bartholomew's Church pieces together the story so that we hope its many twists and turns can be understood. Alice Blakewell, churchwarden of St Bartholomew's, says that the opening of the grave was important, regardless of its occupants. "These were our predecessors living here in Hyde back in medieval times. We are pleased to know a little more about them and are now looking forward to the chance to give them an appropriately dignified reburial later this year," she said. Professor Joy Carter, Vice-Chancellor at the University of Winchester, said, "The exciting and important discovery of a pelvic bone belonging to either King Alfred or his son Edward is testament both to the power of academic research to reach across centuries and to the commitment of the local community. This discovery was very much the result of a partnership with which the university is proud to be associated. Our thanks go to all those involved in the project, including the committed members of Hyde 900, Winchester City Council, the diocese, and of course all our academic colleagues at the university. Their commitment and tenacity have enabled us to reach this historic stage in the search for Alfred. The exhibition In Search of Alfred the Great is open from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday to Saturday, and at times when services are not being held on Sundays."
Pair complete epic Atlantic challenge. Rowers are tired but elated at achievement. They have battled 40-foot waves in some of the most dangerous waters in the world. but two friends are now enjoying being back on dry land after finally completing their epic challenge to row the Atlantic Ocean for charity. Will North from Winchester and Dan Howey arrived at English Harbour in Antigua after rowing 3,000 nautical miles to raise £200,000 for charity. So far, the pair, who met at university, have raised more than £80,000 for leukemia and lymphoma research, Cancer Research UK, and St Anna's, a school and home for orphaned and abandoned children. It is part of the Talisker Whisky Atlantic Challenge, which they completed at 3:30 a.m. on Monday, British time. Will, 28, a headhunter, and Dan, 29, a chartered surveyor from Yorkshire, completed the epic adventure in 53 days, 9 hours and 30 minutes. Will said, "I'm a little tired and feeling quite surreal about seeing dry land, and every joint is aching, but I feel amazing. We didn't really have a target because every year the race is dependent on the conditions, but we wanted to come in the top of the pairs, and that's what we've done." Having left the Canaries on December the 4th, Will and Dan endured some of the worst North Atlantic weather systems in more than 100 years. They've capsized twice, scaled 40-foot waves, and been hit in the face by flying fish. Life on board has been an endless challenge, with injuries, a hot cabin, no auto helm, and the need to hand pump water every day. Will added, "It wasn't nice, but it was going to be hard. Every time I stand up, I'm leaning. I feel like I'm drunk. Somebody gave me a beer last night, and I was all over the place. We came in just after sunset, and then from nowhere there was a wall of people stood screaming our names. Everyone on a yacht nearby was shouting to us as well. They were just so excited. It was what we've thought about every day since starting. It's so good to be here with everyone now, and to finish here, it's the perfect destination." Will's dad, Simon, of Pearson Road, Shawford, said, "We are absolutely elated. The reception they received was phenomenal. They lit a flare when they came in, and all the other crews who have already finished were there rooting for them because they've all bonded with each other so well. It has been out of this world. The interest from all the people in Antigua has been amazing. They cannot believe somebody can row the Atlantic. They've done the most marvellous thing. Will's had not one but two showers this morning, though he's still sprouting the beard, and I'm so proud of what they've achieved. He's my boy." And the item is illustrated by three pictures, one very small one of the pair rowing their boat, and two of them celebrating their arrival at English Harbour in Antigua after rowing 3,000 miles to raise £200,000 for charity.
Full steam ahead for long distance footpath. One of Winchester's hidden treasures is set for a makeover this year as villagers bid for a long distance footpath. Residents from Alsford, Kingsworthy and Itchen Valley hope to create the path on the route of the old Mid-Hampshire Railway, otherwise known as the Watercress Line, which closed in 1973. County Councillor Jackie Porter helped in setting up the Friend of the Line group in May 2012, and volunteers have been researching the length of the line in the hope of making it an official footpath. Earlier this month, they named the line the Watercress Way. The group submitted its idea to the Winchester City Council and is now in talks with the South Downs National Park and Hampshire and Isle of Wight conservation volunteers to get more people clearing undergrowth and making the path a real possibility. Councillor Porter said, "Friends of the Line group has drawn considerably over the past year and now includes three ecologists who are preserving a high-quality habitat along the line for flora and fauna. She said, "We decided to give the long-distance route a name, the Watercress Way, so we can start up a website and attract funding interest. There are traces of the old railway at various points along the way. Over the years, houses have been built at several places along the line, and certain sections are owned by various authorities." Councillor Porter added, "We know there will be places where the path can't follow the old line exactly, but we hope the route will give a sense of the old railway and eventually connect from Alsford through Kingsworthy to Sutton Scotney. The group is planning a long-distance walk in June. For more information, or to sign up to be a friend of the line, email Sarah, S-A-R-A, and Sarah has a capital S, S-A-R-A, at teltrack.com. That's teltrak.com. And there is a photograph of Jackie Porter with members of the Friends of the Line group holding up a banner saying the Watercress Way.
Ellen has talent on tap to land award. A young woman has tapped her way through an international competition to take home first prize. Ellen Ayers from Mill Lane, Droxford, works part-time for her mum, Debbie, at the cafe in Winchester Science Centre and has been tap-tapping away since the age of three. Last month, she and 40 others made up Tap Attack, a team which won gold at the 2013 International Dance Organisation World Tap Championships held in Germany. The 18-year-old said, "I've been doing this actual competition for 5 years. When people think of tap dancing, they think it's old-fashioned. But we decided to mix it up a bit this time and danced to the pop star Calvin Harris. We had never won before, and then to come first was amazing. I'd love to do TV work eventually, but dancing is my main priority, and I want to do all I can to hold on to it." Ellen came away with the title of world champion in the adult formation category, along the other 21 members of the team who competed in the category. England head coach and former tap dancer Joe Scanlon said, "Ellen has worked extremely hard to first be selected for this year's England team and then showed great determination and sacrifice to be crowned world champion. There are around 2,000 tap dancers from nearly 20 countries and Ellen should be very proud of her achievement." Ellen was joined by fellow Hampshire dancers, 17-year-old Chloe Hamilton from Botley, 19-year-old Imogen Weatherhead and 17-year-old Victoria Sarker, both from Southampton. And there's a picture here of them all tapping away.
Sparsholt College opened its farm gates to invite the public in to see the annual lambing. It is one of the highlights of the year for the land-based college near Winchester, with hundreds of people visiting to see the flock of 250 ewes giving birth to a predicted 50 single lambs, 142 twins, and 30 sets of triplets. The operation last weekend was overseen by college shepherd John Garrett, helped by dozens of college students. Mr. Garrett kept up a running commentary, keeping visitors informed of progress. "For anyone overwhelmed by the maternity extravaganza, there was the chance to see the milking of the dairy herd, tractor rides, and a look at agricultural machinery." Event organiser Philip Holroyd-Smith said, "Once again, our lambing weekend has proved a huge success. We often see familiar faces who come back each year. I can't imagine there are many opportunities for people to get so very close to a newborn lamb and to actually witness one being born is incredibly special indeed." There were a number of occasions on Saturday when visitors let out a collective ah as they saw a new lamb arrive. It wasn't only Sparsholt's lambs which had a monopoly on cuteness. The college dairy was open for milking demonstrations, and the young calves drew quite a crowd as visitors explored this facility. Over in the Game and Wildlife Centre, there was metal sculpting, making your own biodegradable plant pot, and face painting. All of which were provided by either Sparsholt students or lecturers from the Motor Vehicle Horticulture or Andover College's Beauty Department.
And another article on the subject of animals is headed TB Test Regime Could Kill Commoning. A national campaign to halt the spread of bovine TB could change the face of the New Forest by halting the movement of cattle. Under proposals drawn up by the government, owners will have to get their animals tested by vets every time they are moved on or off the open forest. The forest is famous for its ponies, but also has 3,500 cows, owned by 140 commoners. Many of those living next door to common land turn their cattle out every day in winter, and all animals would have to be tested each time if DEFRA's proposals were approved. The threat was revealed at the Court of Verderers in Lyndhurst. Official Verderer Dominic May said, "Some form of testing would have to take place before cattle are depastured or brought back to their holding. In some cases, that would technically mean a daily test, which is clearly impossible. Such a rule would stop cattle being turned out." The Verderers have lobbied DEFRA and highlighted the vital role played by grazing in shaping the landscape of the forest. Mr. May added, "We share the grave concern about the spread of TB and very much wish to keep the forest free of TB. We suggest the proposal be replaced by a licence to move cattle freely. DEFRA officers have come down to the forest to learn more about our commoning practices. There are many details to work out, and the Verderers will continue to work with DEFRA to reach a practical and effective solution. The forest will change considerably if cattle are not turned out." Former head Agister Brian Ingram, who keeps cattle near his Bewley home, said, "A great number of commoners across the forest will be finished if this goes ahead." Bovine TB, which can be transmitted to humans, has resulted in 208,170 cattle being culled since 2008. A DEFRA spokesman said, "Bovine TB is one of the biggest challenges faced by the cattle farming industry. The risk to public health is very low, largely due to milk pasteurisation and early identification of TB in cattle. Nevertheless, we need to eradicate bovine TB to support the food and farming industry and reduce the cost to farmers and taxpayers." Bovine TB is an infectious disease that can spread to badgers, which are being culled in some parts of the UK. The number of cases has risen steadily over the past 25 years, with the disease spreading from isolated pockets to cover large areas of the west and southwest of England. It's mainly a respiratory disease caught by breathing in the M. bovis bacteria that causes bovine TB. Bacteria is released into the air through coughing and sneezing, which spreads to uninfected animals. And there is a photograph of some very happy and healthy-looking cattle grazing in the forest.
House prices take off in Hampshire. London-based property hunters have an astonishing £900 million to spend on homes in the Winchester area, according to a leading city estate agent. Strutton Parker, the Jury Street-based agent, claims 700 buyers on its database have an interest in buying locally, and the potential buyers have a combined budget of £864 million, which they are prepared to spend in the region. Many are relocating from the capital, and their equity is a major driver for the climbing prices in Winchester. George Bernand, partner at Stratton Parker, said, "As I understand it, London has had it good for many years, even through the financial crisis. There's an expectation that the country market is about to benefit with people migrating out. We have got an awful lot of people looking to buy in Winchester and the surrounding area. In this neck of the woods, we have exceptionally good state and private schools, beautiful countryside, and train links that get you into London in an hour. When you start looking at where people are going to move to, Winchester is an obvious place. House prices across Hampshire are booming as the property market continues to recover. 10 council wards have seen the average price of homes hit £500,000, with some areas seeing properties edging £800,000. Homeowners in Cheriton and Bishop Sutton, both near Alresford, have seen average prices double in the last 10 years. For many areas, the jump in house prices is due to Londoners leaving the capital. The report, The Most Expensive Housing Markets of England and Wales, which was compiled by estate agents Savills and analysts Property Database, shows how the property market has boomed in the South East over the last decade. It mainly highlights the changes in the London area, but has shown how property prices in the commuter belt are beginning to rise. But other places in Hampshire are also part of the housing boom. Parts of the New Forest and Test Valley have also seen house prices increase rocketly. In the middle of this article, it says, House Price Boom. Included in the 10 wards which have seen house prices boom in excess of 475,000 as of September 2013 are Itchen Valley, where average house price is £798,715, up 44% over 5 years and 75% over the decade. Cheriton and Bishop Sutton, where the average price of a house is £700,153, more than double in 10 years. Oslebury and Curdridge, average £589,279, 61% rise in 10 years. St Michael, Winchester, average £579,165, 21% up in 5 years, 75% in 10. Bourne Valley, Test Valley, average £573,000, up 3% in 5 years, 60% in 10. And Brockenhurst and Forest, South East New Forest, average £545,742, up 38% in 10 years.
Free trial exercise classes for the elderly. Two new exercise classes aimed at helping elderly people maintain their independence and well-being are being launched in Winchester. The Exercise Plus sessions, run by the Winchester Live at Home Scheme, WLAHHS, will be held in Week and Coldon Common. Potential participants are encouraged to come along and try the first class for free to discover if it is suitable for them. The Week class will begin on February the 6th, and will take place every Thursday from 11 at Week Community Centre in Taplings Road. The Coldon Common sessions start on April the 12th and will take place at 11 a.m. every Saturday. All sessions last 1 hour and will be taught by qualified stability instructors. They are designed to maintain and improve posture, strength and balance. Claire Morgan, manager of the WLAHS, said, "These classes aim to help our members maintain independence, improve well-being, and reduce isolation. As well as looking for participants, we also need volunteers to help supervise the classes, support members in their movements, and assist the instructor. A class currently running at St Mark's Church Hall in Oliver's Battery at 2:30 p.m. on Thursdays is also open to new members. The Exercise Plus sessions are supported by Hampshire County Council's Steady and Strong initiative. To book a place at the class or for more information, contact the WLAHS office on 01962 890 995, or email office@wlahs.org. And the item is illustrated by a picture of two ladies going through some of the exercise manoeuvres.
Museum to display ring. A ring once owned by Jane Austen, which was sold to US singer Kelly Clarkson, is set to go on display for the first time at a Hampshire museum next month. It comes after the Jane Austen House Museum in Chawton, near Alton, raised more than £150,000 to buy it back. Miss Clarkson bought it at auction last year, but she was prevented from taking it out of the UK when it became subject to a temporary export ban. Now the gold and turquoise ring will go on display at the museum from February the 14th. Curator of the Jane Austen House Museum, Mary Guyot, said, "The government's decision to decline an export licence, preventing Kelly Clarkson from taking the ring from the UK, reflects how rarely Austen's personal effects turn up in today's art market."
Thank you very much, everyone. Those are the Hampshire Chronicle extracts chosen for you this week. And I'll just remind you again that Irene Dowding is the person to call should you have any problems with your recording. Her number, again, is 01962 870 370. 01962 870 370. And again, we thank our editors, Christine and Fredina, and also the hard-working copying, dispatch and preparation teams. And this is the point where we say thank you very much to our readers, from Claire.
Bye.
And Robin.
Goodbye.
And Jerry.
Goodbye.
And from me, Roz. Goodbye. Can you please put the memory stick in the wallet when you've finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible, putting the address label inside the wallet? Thank you for listening and have a very good week.